This is the Tax Update Podcast for August 18, 2008. This week, keeping things open, life insurance demutualization case. The Tax Update Podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and this document may be reproduced freely as long as no fee is charged for use of the document. Such prohibited use include using the podcast or documents part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. Be sure to visit them on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Now this week we had the major tax services begin to pick up on the decision that came down on August 6th from the Court of Federal Claims, a decision in the case of Fisher versus United States, a case that involved the question of the basis of shares received by an individual who was a policyholder in a mutual life insurance company. The IRS position over the years had been that in such cases the basis of those shares was zero. So any amount received by the shareholder in this particular case, where he received cash in lieu of receiving the shares when the demutualization took place, was all capital gain with no basis. The taxpayer in this case disputed that position, and the Court of Federal Claims ended up agreeing with the taxpayer, creating an issue that for many people is going to involve potential claims for refund if open years involve these issues. Now, this particular taxpayer was an irrevocable trust, and initially the taxpayer took the cash, reported the entire amount as income, taking a zero basis, which was consistent with the letter ruling the insurer had obtained from the IRS for the transaction, and essentially duplicates what the letter rulings given to all the insurers who have done demutualizations in the past decade or so have received from the IRS, stating that there's no tax, it's not a taxable event to the shareholder to receive the shares in demutualization, but those shares have a zero basis, and if they receive cash in lieu, then they have capital gain on that disposition. After filing that return and paying the tax, the taxpayer filed a claim for refund, taking the position that there was truly no gain on the transaction. Now, the key issue being dealt with in this case is the fact that taxpayers in these cases took a single asset, their insurance policy with a mutual insurance company, and that had that split by the company when it demutualized into two pieces, the policy standing alone and the stock in a new company. Now, a policyholder in a mutual insurance company has certain ownership style rights as long as the policy stays in force. Unlike a stockholder, those rights can't be divorced from the policy. If you cease to be a policyholder, you cease to have the rights. But as long as you have those rights, you continue to have those, as long as you have the policy, you continue to have those rights that very much are the ownership style rights in the company, the rights to the to a share of the earnings, and the rights to amounts received in liquidation. Now, a number of mutual insurance companies in the past decade have decided they would prefer to be stock-based insurance companies. That is an insurance company where the ownership is held by stockholders, and the policyholders merely are customers of the company. But to make that conversion, they have to deal with the fact that currently their ownership is the mutual life insurance, is the life insurance policyholders. And so in making that conversion, generally the current policyholders receive under various allocations a amount of shares that represent their interest in the ownership of the company. Now, what happens in that case, of course, is we have a splitting up of what was previously one asset into two. And that's an issue that involves essentially an asset, a basket of assets that we acquired, our ownership style rights, and our insurance policy that were acquired in one transaction. And now we're splitting them into two parts and going to sell only a portion of those assets. That is, in this particular case for Mr. Fisher, since he was going to receive cash in lieu of receiving the stock, he is receiving cash to sell his ownership rights that previously existed in the company, but he's going to retain the insurance policy. Now, generally, we have a basket of assets and end up selling out some. We end up having to allocate bases. Regulation 1.61-6A provides that when part of a larger property is sold, the cost or other basis of the entire property shall be equitably apportioned among the several parts, and the gain realized or loss sustained on the part of the property sold is the difference between the selling price and the cost or other basis allocated to such part. The sale of each part is treated as a separate transaction, and gain or loss shall be computed separately on each part. Thus, gain or loss shall be determined at the time of sale of each part, not deferred until the entire property has been disposed of. So we end up having to allocate basis in order to determine what the gain or loss in the part sold would be. Judge Allegra, who was the judge that ruled in this case, citing a number of cases, noted in the opinion that this apportionment is done by dividing the cost basis of the larger property among its components in proportion to their fair value at the time they were acquired. However, the judge goes on to note, of course, for this formula to work, one must be able to derive the fair market values of the component parts of the larger property. The regulations presume that these values are obtainable, stating that, quote, only in rare and extraordinary cases will property be considered to have no fair value. But what if, despite this regulatory bravado, it proves impractical or impossible to derive the values needed for the basis apportionment formula, at least without engaging in undue speculation? Does that mean none of the basis of the original acquired property is allocable to the part disposed of, or that all of it is allocable thereto until exhausted? These questions, of course, beg a deeper inquiry into how, if at all, Treasury Regulation 1.61-6 applies in such circumstances. Whether, for example, conditions not immediately apparent, perhaps those lying in the substructure of the income tax, serve to delimit the regulation. As you might guess, our problem is this exact question of how to split up basis in the case of demutualization. Now, the IRS position has been clear for quite a while, dating back to the 70s. All basis remains with the policy, and the resulting shares have a zero basis. In this particular case, the insurer, Sun Life, sought an IRS ruling on the tax status of the proposed demutualization transaction, and the ruling came to the same conclusion the IRS has always arrived at. Quoting from the opinion, on May 19, 2000, in response to a request from the company, the Internal Revenue Service issued Private Letter Ruling 2020-048, which dealt with various tax aspects of the demutualization. In that ruling, the IRS noted the aforementioned ownership rights cannot be obtained by any purchase separate from an insurance contract issued by Sun Life. It ruled that under Section 351A1 of the Internal Revenue Code of 1986, no gain or loss shall be recognized by the eligible policyholders on the deemed exchange of their ownership rights solely for company stock. It further opined that the basis of the company stock deemed to be received by the eligible policyholders in the exchange will be the same basis as the ownership rights surrendered in exchange for such company stock, that is, zero. It's important to note that the question of the basis of company stock wasn't really the key issue that Sun was looking at here in getting this resolved in the ruling. Sun's issue was this a tax-free transaction when we split these two components? That's the ruling they were looking for. As well, as the court pointed out, the PLR wouldn't be binding on the shareholders, and the IRS really didn't rule on this matter so much as simply parrot what Sun had said, who was parroting the old IRS rulings. In a footnote to the opinion, it was noted that, but that ruling merely parroted factual representations made by Sun Life and is of little moment in this case. While Sun Life could rely on that ruling in its dealings with the IRS, the ruling had utterly no binding or precedential impact on the tax treatment entitled by third parties, such as plaintiff here. The question of how the IRS has tended to arrive at zero basis conclusion and whether that reasoning is valid was a matter to be decided in this case. However, that was after an earlier decision in which the court had rejected the view that this should be viewed as a policy dividend excluded from income under Section 72. The court summarized its earlier decision in a footnote noting, Section 72 of the Code provides rules governing the reporting of income corresponding to annuities received under an annuity, endowment, or life insurance contract. Section 72(e)(2) includes from gross income of certain amounts not received as annuity, among them any amounts received which is in the nature of a dividend or similar distribution, as defined in Section 73(e)(1)(b). In its November 15, 2006 opinion, court held the amounts received by the plaintiff did not qualify for exclusion under these provisions, finding that the plaintiff had received these proceeds upon an entirely unrelated sale of the stock it received in the demutualization. In its post-trial brief, plaintiff asked the court to reconsider this ruling, the court sees no basis for doing so. So the taxpayer's case rests on the issue of whether basis could be allocated to the stock sold, and if so, how would that be done? Now we go to the open transaction doctrine. It's important to note that what was decided in this case was not really a matter of law. In fact, in many ways, the parties didn't disagree on the law that it's in general applicable, just how these facts fit into that particular law, and perhaps whether the facts in the case were or were not distinguishable from other cases. As the court noted in denying taxpayers' motion for summary judgment on the issue that there was no gain to be reported, the court concluded that it could not resolve as a matter of law plaintiff's claim that no capital gain was realized on the sale of the financial services stock because the proceeds were offset by plaintiff's basis in the stock, finding that the claim presented material questions of facts that required a trial. So back when they had ruled that Section 72 didn't apply, the court also said we have to go to trial on the factual question of whether or not there was basis in the shares that were sold, or how do we report that gain? So we have here the court ruling on the question of fact that it was presented and which it had said we needed to hear evidence on back in November of 2006. That's important because, as we will see, the court simply found the taxpayer's expert was more persuasive on the matter at hand when it came to decide whether or not the open transaction doctrine could be applied in this case. While the opinion suggests it might be difficult to convince the court otherwise that open transaction doctrine would not apply, either a better analysis by the IRS expert or if the facts weren't exactly equivalent to the Sun Life facts, we need to be aware that this was a case decided on the facts, so changes in those two could very well change the result in court. And specifically, as is often referred to in the decision, the facts were one of rare and extraordinary cases where the fair market values could not be obtained. Conversely, if a court could be persuaded that the values could be obtained at the time of demutualization, then the rationale of the decision would require a much different result. Which brings us to the open transaction doctrine, a doctrine the IRS argued simply did not apply to this case, and which the taxpayers claimed did. Now, I should say, when we talk about the change in the values, not necessarily time of demutualization, the court was interested at the time of acquisition of the policy. The court examined the doctrine of the open transaction doctrine beginning with the following discussion of the 1931 United States Supreme Court Logan case. To quote the court, into this evolving legal environment was born the so-called open transaction doctrine. Accoutrements traced to Burnett versus Logan, 1931 United States Supreme Court case. In that case, Mrs. Logan sold stock of a closely held corporation, which assets included stock in a second corporation that owned a mine lease. She and the other shareholders, which included her mother, exchanged the stock for cash in a stream of annual payments that corresponded to the amount of iron ore extracted from the mine. The IRS argued that at the time of the sale, the right to receive the mining royalties could be estimated based upon the amount of reserves at the mine, and the transaction should be taxed based upon the amount of that estimate. The Supreme Court demurred, holding that Mrs. Logan was entitled to recoup her capital investment in the stock before paying income tax based on the supposed market value of the mineral payments. It reasoned, as annual payments on account of extracted ore come in, they are readily apportioned first as a return of capital, later as profit. The liability for income tax ultimately can be fairly determined without resort to mere estimates, assumptions, and speculations. When the profit, if any, is actually realized, the taxpayer will be required to respond. The consideration for the sale was $2,200,000 in cash, and the promise of future money payments wholly contingent upon facts and circumstances not possible to foretell with anything like fair certainty. The promise was in no proper sense equivalent to cash. It had no ascertainable fair market value. The transaction was not a closed one. She properly demanded the return of her capital investment before assessment of any taxable profit based on conjecture. Notably, Mrs. Logan's mother owned stock in the same company and sold on the same term. She, however, died and her payments under the same sales agreement were valued for estate tax purposes. The Supreme Court, however, summarily dismissed the notion that valuation of the payment stream for estate tax purposes should be used for income tax purposes, stating, some valuation, speculative or otherwise, was necessary in order to close the estate. It may never yield as much, it may yield more. It is useful to note here that the problem for Mrs. Logan wasn't dividing up basis. Rather, in her case, the problem was the amount to be received was unknown. The court noted, waxing a bit poetic in its writing, that from the beginning, the open transaction doctrine developed like a pavane, intertwined in theory but rarely touching the decisional law. The opinion continued to reinforce the rarity of application of the doctrine, likely to limit the application of this decision outside of the fact pattern we have here. It turns out there is a precedential court of claims case that involves a matter of an uncertain split of basis. And even better for us, it was a case where the IRS was arguing for the application of the open transaction doctrine. It's always nice when we have a situation where we're looking to establish or get a ruling. We're looking to say our situation should be taxed as follows, and we can find the case where the IRS was arguing for the same treatment in what looks like a similar transaction. The court said, quote, a dozen years after Logan in Pierce versus United States, it was not the taxpayer but the United States that claims that a transaction was still open. In that case, First National Bank of the City of New York, in order to give its stockholders the benefits of investments and securities that could not then be lawfully held by a bank, organized a separate company, First Security Company, to invest in such securities. Each of the certificates of stock in the bank was endorsed with a statement that the stockholder had an interest in the dividends or profits, and in case of dissolution, in the distribution of capital of the surety company, ratable with the interest in the bank. Via this arrangement, the shareholders also had limited control of the security company, a buyout control exercised through the votes of the holders of two-thirds of the bank stock. Neither the bank stock by itself nor the interest represented by the endorsement could be transferred separately from the other. Between 1928 and 1932, plaintiff's testator bought 35 shares of bank stock with the endorsements. The Banking Act of 1933, however, banned the securities arrangement used by the bank, causing the security company to be dissolved, transferable interest in the proceeds of dissolution were issued to bank stockholders, and the endorsements were removed from the shareholder certificates of bank stock. The plaintiff testator received his interest in the proceeds of the dissolution on December 6, 1933, and promptly sold them on January 29, 1934, allegedly at a loss on account of which they sought a refund of income taxes. The United States contended that the sale by plaintiff testator of the declarations of interest in the dissolution of security company may not be treated separately as showing a loss, since its interest in the security company was acquired in combination with the stock in the bank, and the answer to the question whether a loss or profit resulted from the transaction cannot be had until the blank stock is sold, so it may be known how much the combined investment is sold for. While conceding that, in some instances, the apportionment of the amount of single purchase price to several items purchased for a single total price may be had, defendant asseverated that the situation presented was not a proper case for such apportionment, since it would not be practicable here. The court took the latter contention to mean that no particular value could be assigned to the interest in the security company represented by the endorsement on the bank stock as of the date of purchase of the bank stock with any degree of assurance that the assignment of value was correct or even approximately so, requiring the answer to the question of profit and loss to wait till the bank stock is sold. Readily agreeing with this proposition, the court reasoned an attempt here to attribute a certain value to the interest in the security company acquired by plaintiff's testator involves us in largely in guesswork. Rejecting the plaintiff's attempt to value the endorsement, the court found that we do not think the situation calls for such a rough estimate when by patience the exact answer may be obtained. The upshot, the court concluded, was that the commissioner acted within his power in refusing to permit the deduction. The court notes a matter the IRS would argue solve this matter. The issuance of Regulation 1.61-6 we discussed earlier back in 1957. The court notes that this regulation generalized the application of the doctrine of allocating basis to the various parts received, that it should work similarly as it did in a specific regulation that was directed to real estate property that was being subdivided and sold in pieces. However, the court noted, nevertheless, even after this new and broader regulation was promulgated, both taxpayers and the commissioner continued to invoke the open transactions doctrine and at times did so successfully. Sometimes, as in Logan, the doctrine was pressed by taxpayers claiming that no gain should be realized upon a sale of a portion of the given property until the basis of the entire original property acquired was recovered. In other instances, the defendant invoked the doctrine in seeking either to 1) postpone income to years in which the statute of limitations on assessment was still open, or two, argue that no loss could be deducted upon the sale or exchange of property until all the interest comprised in the property had been sold or exchanged. The court also noted that the passage of Internal Revenue Code Section 453 also served to limit the open transaction doctrine, but not in a way that impacted the case here. The court notes, yet the legislative history of this section confirms that Congress envisioned that the open transaction doctrine would still be available, albeit to use the word in one report, in rare and extraordinary circumstances. That's a term we keep seeing. As it bears noting that none of the statutes directly address the impact of the doctrine on basis allocation, the form of the doctrine presented here. Accordingly, while these statutes undoubtedly narrowed the scope of the doctrine, they did not defenestrate it. The doctrine survives, albeit in a more limited form, but with its basic rationale unscathed, leading the court to apply it as appropriate. Thus, finding the open transaction doctrine was still viable in the right fact pattern, though in more limited cases, the court went on to look at the experts' opinions in these cases. Key question was going to arise was whether or not the rights were impossible to value or were valueless. The court noted that experts for both sides agreed on a number of factors, including the fact that the rights prior to demutualization could not be sold separately. But the key issue was the experts differed on what that meant. The court first noted the position of the taxpayer's expert when saying that the plaintiff's valuation expert, Mr. Cole, opined that traditional methods could not be used to value the ownership rights associated with the policy because those rights were neither separable nor alienable. While convinced those rights added value to the policy, he concluded that prior to demutualization of Sun Life, their fair value separate from the policy itself was not determinable. The key position noted here is Mr. Cole's conclusion that, in fact, the rights did add value to the policy, even though there might not be susceptible to valuation using traditional methods. The IRS's experts took a different view of what that meant. They viewed the lack of ability to value somewhat differently and, in fact, suggested that it gave us no value for those items. The court goes on to note Mr. Reiskell's position, the first expert. Of the defendant's experts, Mr. Reiskell previously worked at a mutual insurance company. He confirmed many of the premises underlying Mr. Cole's opinion. Contrasting the ownership rights of mutual policyholders to those traditional shareholders, Mr. Reiskell observed that unlike shareholder ownership rights that are separate from the contractual rights of the insurance policy, mutual policies' ownership rights are inextricably tied to the underlying insurance contract. He further noted that the policyholder ownership rights could not be separately purchased, transferred, or sold, and that there is no separately determinable or identifiable price for those ownership rights at the time purchase of a policy. Yet, in a somewhat self-contradictory fashion, Mr. Reiskell proceeded to set a value for these rights, specifically concluding, based upon various factors, they had no value. Court then turned to the IRS's other expert, Mr. Penny. It notes, the court's defendant's other expert, Mr. Penny, also recognized that the subject ownership rights could not be purchased nor sold separate from the purchase of an insurance policy. But he essentially turned a blind eye to this fact, including the value of the ownership right was best stated at zero during the 1990 calendar year. To derive this value, Mr. Penny reportedly used cost and market-based approaches to valuation based on his view of the cost of replacing the asset and its market value respectively. Yet he did so conspicuously without considering any comparable properties, serving to highlight the fact there were neither such comparables nor, for that matter, any market in which the ownership rights or some derivative could be sold. The court noted and commented on these divergent positions and explained, so what caused these differences? It would appear that the experts parted company in deciding whether the nature of the ownership's rights made them impossible or impractical to value or simply valueless. And that disagreement in turn undoubtedly stemmed from unstated differences as to what is meant by the phrase impossible or impractical, a phrase that, despite dozens of open transaction cases, has received little in the way of direct definition. The phrase impossible or impractical has largely been left undefined, almost undoubtedly derives from the fact that most open transaction cases are heavily fact-driven. Nonetheless, a synthesis of the decisional law reveals several factors that have proven pivotal in deciding whether a rational basis exists for determining fair market value. After noting various factors, specifically marketability of the asset in question, the lack of proxies to be used as comparables to value the assets, and the value being contingent upon factors not possible to foretell with any degree of confidence, the court notes logic and experience suggest that the presence of the above factors ought to be reflecting the ability or inability of an expert to value an asset reliably using accepted valuation methods. The latter methods, of course, are not intended to produce results with talismanic precision, for it is well accepted that the fair market value is incapable of mathematical precision and implicates methods of judgment. Yet, empirically speaking, if an expert lacks any rational basis upon which to value an asset, that ought to be a strong indication that the asset is insusceptible of valuation. As noted, given the Pierce holding, the court is willing to apply the open transaction doctrine if, in fact, the valuation is impossible. But the court warns that the burden of showing that impossibility falls directly on the taxpayer. To quote the court, "The burden of demonstrating this, of course, lies squarely upon the one invoking the exception, here the plaintiff, which must show that there was not enough hard information in place from which willing buyers and willing sellers could construct sound-based equations of value. Ultimately, it falls to the court to consider the record evidence bearing on the factors listed above, with particular focus given the expert opinions provided, and to determine, as a factual matter, whether the plaintiff has proved that a rational basis for establishing the value of the asset in question is lacking." Put quickly, that last question is the key to this decision, because that was what the court decided was a key question of fact that was going to determine whether we had an open transaction doctrine, where we would be able to recover our basis first, and only after basis was fully recovered would gain be recognized, or would we have a case where that was not the case, it was properly valued, and that value was zero because there was a way to value it, and the court would agree with the IRS, potentially at least, that that value should be zero, and then the gain would be taxable. But even if they didn't agree with the IRS that the value was zero, if it was capable of being valued, then we would still allocate basis and may very well still have a taxable gain on sale, especially if the court decided that the proper value would be a relatively low value for those rights on the mutual insurance policy. The court concluded in the end that the plaintiff had met the burden required of the plaintiff to show that, in fact, there was no rational basis upon which we could determine the allocation of basis. The court notes that, with this background, after carefully weighing the evidence, the court finds that this case presents one of the rare and extraordinary situations in which the open transaction exception to Regulation 1.616 should apply. Of the experts who testified, the court is persuaded that Mr. Cole, who was, you may remember, the plaintiff's expert, most accurately considered the realities of the circumstances presented here and the limitation on valuations inherent therein. In particular, he focused on the fact the ownership's rights were at the outset inextricably tied to the underlying insurance policy and were not separately sellable. Both he and, to a certain extent, Mr. Ryskel viewed this fact as an important indication that policy rights lacked a determinable fair market value at the time when the policy in question was first acquired. Now, remember, in passing, that was also something the court had decided that was part of the Pierce decision, where the IRS had argued you couldn't separate the two, and there was no rational basis to allocate the basis of the two different rights that were inherent in what, in the case of Pierce, the taxpayer had bought when they bought the bank stock. Now, going on in this case, the court also noted that this was different from holding there was no value, the position the IRS needed to sustain for the entire amount to be taxable. While the IRS experts had testified the rights had no value, the court noted, notably, Mr. Penny readily admitted that there was neither a market upon which to gauge the value of ownership rights, nor any assets that could be deemed comparable to those rights, so as to allow for accurate application of the market method of valuation. Rather, he and, to a lesser extent, Mr. Ryskel, set the value of the ownership rights at zero because Sun Life had not incurred any costs establishing those rights. That is, prior to demutualization, Sun Life had neither associated any costs with the ownership rights on its books, nor accounted for those rights in pricing its policies. However, the court found that factor to be irrelevant at best, as it viewed it from the wrong perspective, that of whether Sun or the policyholder had values involved there. And as the court noted, it could just as well be deemed to be evidence that such rights were inherently intertwined with the policy so deeply there was simply no rational way to separate those costs out and segregate them on Sun's books. There, not that in fact they were a no-cost item. The court also dealt with the idea, which the IRS seems to imply in their prior ruling, that this is somehow a windfall for the taxpayers and that they should pay tax because this is just a bit of income that they had no right to expect. It noted, defendants' repeated and pejorative use of that term, that is windfall, seemingly proceeds from a notion that, as in Orphic hymns, the value associated with the ownership rights here sprung from the ether, somehow sparked by the demutualization itself. As characterized by Mr. Scanlon, one of the defendant's witnesses, these rights were embedded values that were not monetized until demutualization occurred. But if there was any meaningful distinction to be made between embedded values that were not previously monetized and ownership rights that were impossible or impractical to value at the time they were first acquired, it is almost certainly one without a difference. Nor is there the slightest support for the suggestion, again made by one of defendant's witnesses, that the allocation of the stock here was a windfall because it was mandated by Canadian and state regulatory agencies. A silent premise in this argument is, of course, that those agencies acted arbitrarily, or at least with considering largesse and requiring compensation to be paid for loss of ownership rights that, in defendants' views, were valueless. But the court is no more inclined to believe this charge sans any shred of evidence to support it than it would be to ascribe similar conduct to Congress and federal agencies. Without any evidence to the contrary, the more logical conclusion is that such agencies and the legislatures that empowered them sincerely believed the ownership rights had value and the policyholders were entitled to be compensated for their loss. The windfall tag, therefore, lacks evidentiary adhesive and does not stick. At all events, the assertion that the ownership rights ever had a zero value is thoroughly rebuffed by the actuarial study provided by Sun Life to its policyholders with the plan for demutualization. The study focused on whether the stock to be provided to mutualization adequately compensated those policyholders for the ownership rights being relinquished. It recognized as a first principle that the stock allocation should fairly compensate for what the policyholders lose in demutualization, namely voting control of the insurance company and the right to share in the insurance company's residual value if it's wound up. It is noted that the demutualization plan provided for a fixed allocation of 75 financial services shares to each eligible policyholders, regardless of the number of policies held, and for a variable allocation to each eligible policy of the number of financial services shares, which depends on the cash value, the number of years it had been in force, and its annual premium. The study stated that, regarded the fixed allocation as compensation for regarded the fixed allocation as compensation for loss of voting control, and the variable allocation as compensation for the loss of right to share in the residual value. It is appropriate that the fixed allocation be the same to each eligible policyholder, since each has one vote and all the votes should be treated as equal. It is appropriate to be the variable allocation differ among eligible policyholders because they have different customer attachments to, different financial interest in, and different rights to receive surplus distributions from Sun Life of Canada. In concluding that the compensation for lost ownership was fair, equitable, and appropriate, the report cited several other facts that suggest ownership rights had value prior to demutualization, including that 1. Value comparable to that being offered in Sun Life demutualization had been allocated to voting rights in other prior demutualizations. 2. The loss of voting control could indirectly impact policy dividends, the payment of which was largely at the discretion of Sun Life's board of directors. And 3. The primary historical source of surplus for Sun Life had been its individual participating policies. Finally, and importantly, the report recognized that distribution of stock was a zero-sum game. That is to say, certain policyholders would be harmed if the plan struck the wrong balance between the value of policy rights and residual rights. Of course, there would be no such harm, and concomitantly, no need to strike such a careful balance, if either right properly were characterized as a windfall. In what may be the most unkind slap at the IRS, the court noted in sum, based on the record, the court simply cannot credit defendant's zero valuation of the ownership rights. That's important because only a pure zero valuation would give a result the IRS demands, even if the open transaction doctrine did not apply. That is, if we could value those assets, and that asset had real value, and the court certainly seemed to believe that if it was possible to be valued, there was true value there, because otherwise we wouldn't be giving these people shares of the stock in the demutualization transaction, that we would take the values and use that to allocate our basis between the two properties and the two types. In fact, when I first read articles discussing this topic years ago, authored, as I remember, by Burgess Raby and his father, Burgess being the plaintiff's attorney in this case, they emphasized the IRS ruling seemed to grab the zero basis position as a given and not really give us any background about why basis of zero is the appropriate right in this case. So where do we stand? We do have some issues here. In this particular case, the taxpayers cashed out immediately. But given the time when most demutualizations took place for many insurers, those years will likely be closed for most taxpayers unless they had filed a protective claim waiting for the outcome of this case or any other case dealing with the matter. However, for taxpayers that held on to the stock, those could have been sold in open years or they may still be holding the stock. In those cases, a real issue would be what would now be the basis of those shares. In a Leinberg Services article discussing this decision, Steve Leinberg quoted Burgess Raby as suggesting he believed a likely solution was that the shares took their fair value at the instant of demutualization. In essence, our basis in the policy was reduced by the fair value of the shares when we split the two up. But that wouldn't necessarily be the only solution, and any position that you take on this matter would have to be researched to determine its standing and whether the position was one that would require disclosure. Similarly, if a taxpayer cashes in the insurance policy, that floating basis issue also becomes a problem, since the basis in the policy is one of the factors used to determine gain or loss disposition. The IRS position made this simple, all the basis was in the policy. But in fact, if part of that basis bled over into the new shares, then gain could be triggered on a surrender even when it would appear otherwise the taxpayer had no such gain, or at least the gain would be larger. Now, we still have to watch for what the IRS response to this case will be, including whether they will appeal. As well, right now, we've only heard from the Court of Claims. We still will be watching to see if any cases come out that involve the tax court for someone who claimed this on their initial return, the district courts for someone who decided to take their refund claim that route, as well as whether any such cases make them to the various circuit courts of appeal. This particular case in the Court of Claim would make it to the federal circuit. Obviously, district court or tax court cases would make it to the other circuits. But we should notify potentially affected clients of the fact that this potential benefit is out there and they may need to consider whether refund claims should be filed. For most clients, the first open year is going to be, at this point in time, would be the 2005 year, although some clients may have 2004 open if their returns are on extension. We need to take a look at those potentially open returns and ask clients about potentially obtaining the necessary information in order to file protective claims based upon this particular case and see where the future goes from there to at least hold our statute open for that purpose. As well, we're going to have to consider the fact that this particular case, obviously, different courts may come to a different conclusion. A court may disagree with the conclusion of law that open transaction doctrine would be the governing here. A court may disagree that it's impossible or may come under the expert testimony they have at their time that it was impossible to value. But what is somewhat interesting is that I do think, as a practical matter, it seems difficult for the IRS to sustain a pure zero basis. It would seem that unless a court totally rejected the logic of this or came to the conclusion that, in fact, those interests were valueless, which seems, at least at first glance, to be somewhat of a stretch considering that people are compensated, apparently need to be compensated for giving up those rights. But if a court concluded they were valueless, we could be back to the IRS position. Now, this has been the tax update for August the 18th, 2008. As always, the tax update is brought to you by Leinberg Information Services located on the web at www.leinbergservices.com. Be sure to visit them and take a look at the offerings they have for subscribers to get information about current federal tax developments, including this past week, a discussion of this particular case. This has been the Tax Update.